Good morning, Winter Park, Florida. You're listening to WPRK 91.5 FM, the voice of Rollins College and the best in basement radio. Today, of course, as always, on every Wednesday morning from 9 to 10, you're listening to Secrets of the Fairies with Dr. Charlotte Tronquet-Dulies.
Hello. Good morning, everyone.
Child expert Talia Balak.
Hello.
And Benny Balak as well, of course.
Hello.
And today our very special guest, Molly Dutton.
Actually, it's Molly Canole, but that's okay.
Oh, okay.
I am married to Robert Dutton, and that's cool.
Ah, very nice, very nice. Us.
He was a guest, exactly. Yes, he was.
We had a Robert Dutton.
He was one of our favorite guests, to be honest. We got a lot of really good feedback for his show.
Yes.
That's awesome.
Awesome.
Well, Molly's here with us today because she's in the Fringe Festival.
That's right.
You're doing a show. You're an actress.
That's right. And I wrote a show that's in the Fringe that actually probably has a lot of parallels to the discussion that will evolve today. So I can't wait.
That's awesome. Before we get to all of that, we're going to have Talia read our fan challenge of the week. Mulan.
And we have to announce that the fairy of the week is
Genevieve Cooper.
Genevieve?
I think it's she, you could call her Genevieve, which is the modern.
Genevieve Cooper, then. Okay.
Do you start? Yes, definitely. We are eager to hear the challenge of the week.
Mulan challenge. It doesn't have a name. Whatever. Miranda never did anything that was easy. Perhaps it was because she liked the challenge, or perhaps because she always went after things that required intellect and not the ability to cheer or dance or cook. Throughout school, she always excelled in academics. A leader among her peers, as student government president, president of the debate team, and consistent winner of both science fair and spelling bees. In doing so, her peers were often boys. She learned that aggressiveness, a competitive spirit, and critical thinking skills were all necessary characteristics in hobbies she enjoyed, but also in her interactions with her male peers. In middle school, she ignored gossip about who was wearing what and instead debated who built a better volcano. In high school, she avoided the talk of who was sleeping with whom and instead debated the need to add a recycling program to the campus. In college, she avoided sorority rushes.
I'm happy my daughter doesn't even know how to say that. Sorry to all my sorority friends.
And instead wrote an honors thesis on human rights, equality, and international law. By the time she reached corporate America as a recent law graduate, she fully knew the people who surrounded her, men. Looking in the mirror, Miranda saw a young woman stare back, decked out in an Ann Taylor suit she found at the outlet mall. She would say that it was a black suit, but most women would categorize it as charcoal. Her dark hair was long enough for her to push behind her ears. Only a few strands fell before her face. Most women would complain about how flat and boring their hair was with Miranda's do, but she loved the convenience of only having to brush through the strands to complete her look. Her beauty routine consisted of applying mascara, which often resulted in her poking her eyes, and using a generous amount of chapstick that she usually ate off 5 minutes later. MAC Cosmetics, Smashbox, and L'Oreal were all words she'd never used in her vocabulary, much less hair dryer, smoothing serum, or moisturizer. If she could wear Crocs to the law firm without being laughed out, she would have a closet full of them in every color.
Ew.
So when it came, Crocs are awesome.
They're awesome.
Crocs are awesome.
I have dressy Crocs.
I wore Crocs to the studio yesterday.
Crocs are awesome. Okay. So when it came down to getting ready in the morning, Miranda put her focus on finding a decent breakfast in under 5 minutes, scoring a sit on the subway and making it into the first elevator upon arriving to the firm. Once getting to the 14th floor of the firm, avoiding the disappointed fashion stares of the receptionist and secretaries required much more of her attention than whether or not she was swishing her hips to her hips enough to appease her male colleagues. While she was one of the hardest working, if not the hardest working partner at the firm, she had to work significantly harder to prove herself to her peers and clients. And because of this, Miranda has a tendency to isolate herself in her work, put on a harsh exterior, and become quick-witted and savvy in her speech. Okay. Turn back on computer. Okay. I'm not sure if any of these are bad words, which is why I'm going to
It's okay, Daddy. I'll put my finger on the dump button while we're...
Well, I know that one's a bad word, but I don't know if the other two...
Oh, yeah.
Just say beep.
Dangerous territory.
Here we go.
Skip the first two, I suppose.
Okay.
Yeah, skip the first two.
Thank you, Genevieve Guinevere.
Okay. Three. Okay. Something, spinster, lesbian, ugly. Honestly, the list goes on to the names given her because of her passion for her work. But why? Because in a male-dominated world, once a woman challenges the norm and enters it, she declares war.
Word.
Next page. The ultimate battle in the war that Miranda fought each day as she entered the firm, occurred when her increasingly growing stomach gained some unwanted attention. Skeptical glances, whispers out of the corner of her mouths, hidden points to her stretched stomach became more common with each day. However, the hardest tactic to decide was where does a professional woman find professional pregnancy pants? Because this concept is virtually non-existent. Miranda's Anne Tyler suits became tighter and tighter, and her collared shirts no longer had a slight intake. No longer had a slight intake at the waist, and her pants could often not button. In attempts to maintain her professionalism, larger male button downs became her only option, covered by an equally large male blazer draped over her ever-growing stomach. Once her stomach could no longer be ignored, one of the partners sat Miranda down to discuss the complications of her arriving child. "Miranda, you're clearly pregnant. When did you plan on telling us?" he addressed. Miranda stared blankly and replied, "I had no intention on making an announcement to you or anyone else in the firm. The condition of my body, my life, and family conditions have nothing to do with my work." While he considered this for a moment, Miranda took a sharp breath and continued. "Well, actually, now that you mention it, with the arrival of my child, my financial responsibilities will in fact grow. So perhaps we should consider the possibility of a raise." This was a statement that caught her partner off guard, even so more than the first declaration by his peer. Yet, after he let that sit in, he couldn't ignore that the fact that the other two partners, and even himself, did in fact get a raise with the growth of their families. "While I am a single mother to this child, I still have a family to take care of. The war on women can only stop once we acknowledge the injustice between genders. It's your move." Miranda explained and left her partner once again speechless.
Fiend. Nice, very good.
Begs the question: Bravo. Who's the father, Jackie. Though?
Totally.
Maybe that'll be the co-worker. Yeah.
Yeah, that was a nice, a pretty nice twist on the Mulan war. You know, woman.
That was probably my favorite
as a man and
favorite challenge. Well, she didn't have to disguise her sex; she actually had to disguise her pregnancy. I think that's what she was disguising in that one. That was one of my favorite fan challenges. Probably so far.
That was really good. You know, a lot today we kind of say, we don't have racism anymore because we don't mind black people. Oh, we don't have sexism anymore because we don't mind women. But actually, we have plenty of it. In fact, more than more than in a long time.
Well, and she had to disguise her identity, as you were saying, because she had to fit in with the working world, which was all men, which was a different way of disguising her identity.
Oh, we don't have sexism. Women can go to work, but they don't have childcare, they don't have support, they have to juggle twice as much stuff.
And they're paid a lot less, etc.
So we don't recognize the fact that women are necessary for society, which is really a death wish. I mean, think about it for a second, you know. Oh, we don't value raising children.
My only thing about that about that story that I noticed was at the very beginning when it was discussing her early years as a student. Don't you think it propagates a little bit of a sexism to say that a girl who's even interested in science would be in classes with all boys to begin with? I mean, what? Mm-hmm. I don't understand that at all. That beginning kind of threw me off at first. I wasn't sure where the story was going until she had entered the professional world, which I can understand that. But in school, I don't think that, I mean, at least for myself, I remember always loving math and science.
Yeah, but you're in a minority. Again, it's not biological, despite, you know, some people still claim it today. It's remarkable. We thought we got rid of that 19th century pseudoscience. But no, today you have famously Larry Summers, you know, the first economic advisor to the president in 2008, president of Harvard, you know, who said that, that women are genetically less predisposed for math and science.
There was a big uproar
with all the, you know, there was an uproar, no doubt, but the fact that our most respectable, most powerful men who dominate everything, politics, academia.
But why didn't she have any girlfriends?
It's a sad reality, but it's a reality.
I remember being when I was in high school, I took a lot of honors, math, and science classes, and I remember my senior year, I took three science classes. And one of them, our honors physics class, which had a lot of the same guys that I had been in classes with since my freshman year, we had 19 guys and one girl.
Right.
So it is a minority. Why? I mean, I remember loving those subjects. I still do. I wasn't the only girl in my class.
Hey, but you majored in art, didn't you?
I did.
I think that there's, it's not that there's... it's not the... Because you're right. There is no... There is no predisposition?
Yeah.
There is no predisposition for or against it, but I just think that culturally, I think what you're right about is culturally it's expected more for women to be more into arts and men to be more into math and sciences. And I actually experienced the opposite as a music student. Almost all my peers are women.
Right.
I mean, there are men in music, but when I sit down and I remember... Like in our vocal labs, when I look at all the vocal majors, there's only five or six guys to 20 to 30 women.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, because a guy singing will get the same kind of words that, the Talia didn't care to read.
Especially being a tenor, which is a higher voice, I've been called gay for years.
Of course.
And I'm straight.
I remember, like, back in the 80s and 90s, or 90s in France, they did some studies and they checked on the level of or on the grades. They took samples of girls and boys in math and sciences, like physics, chemistry, and biology classes, and they checked them for 5 years at a time, and the girls in fact had significantly better results in the science classes than the boys.
Yeah.
And it went for a 10-year, you know, so for 10 years they were following a bunch of kids throughout their high school.
I believe this. 4 years.
And significantly, I mean, every single time, the girls had better grades. So they cognitively understood better math and science than the men
That's
did.
That's not genetic either, you know. I mean, there's no such thing. By the way, let's clear that that biologists are clearing their hair out. We are not stupid. We do know our stuff. The question of between is it genetics, is it upbringing, right? Is it nurture, is it nature,
is it
a stupid question.
Yeah,
it's just a wrong question because both of them are always interconnected.
Yeah.
You know, they're activated at the most mechanical level of genetics, as all the way up to cultural studies.
Yeah,
so it's a false dichotomy.
Yeah, because it could totally have been the fact that those girls and boys were in a trial, you know, and so just because of that, they wanted to show that they were better.
The incentive of pride.
Exactly. When you're in a tribe like that, you never really know what's the incentive. Yeah, exactly.
I will say this, like, from what I've studied, the hemispheres of the brain, which I don't even necessarily believe in as a person being left-brained or right-brained, but I do believe that as a whole-brained person, you know, certain things are fired in certain places for certain reasons. Well, the left brain really does control language, music, and math. And the right side, the arts and sciences, which are more abstract.
They both fire together. That's another thing that's been debunked like 3 years ago. It's very complex. The more we're at the stage in understanding the brain where we're realizing we're not understanding more. We're realizing how little we understand, which is a good place to be. Some of us are old enough to remember the Genome Project in the 90s. We were all like, yeah. And then when we finally mapped the entire genome, we realized, oh my God, nothing's tied one-to-one to genes. It's all complex networks of genes. So our problem just became several orders of magnitude, you know, several zeros bigger than we expected, right? So if nothing else, it's good to teach us that we know even little less than we thought we did, which is the source of wisdom, so it's a good place to be.
Well,
I think one interesting thing to bring up, we're talking about the girls performing better in the study, I can look around as a college student, and it is in the last 10 years or so, college students are overwhelmingly women.
Yeah.
And it makes me ask the question.
Here particularly, but overall that is absolutely true.
Well, even when I was at Valencia, which, you know, is a community college, it was mostly women, and I've always wondered why that is. And one thing that I would bring up, which might be a little controversial, is I think as the role of women in society has changed, and most of that has been a good thing, I disagree with some of it, but most of it has been a good thing, I think as the role of women in society has changed, the role of men has come into question, and I think you've got an entire generation of men who don't know where they belong, don't know what their purpose
is. Absolutely.
Because for generations, for hundreds of years, the purpose of the man was to provide for his family, and now that women are providing for the families, which is not a bad thing, you end up with all these young men, my age and younger and older than I.
Identity crisis.
Yeah, exactly. Don't know, what is our purpose? Why should we care? Because if the girls no longer want us to provide for them, then what's the point of us doing it?
Oh, yeah, we do.
And at the same time,
we
want
to provide for ourselves, but we need you to provide for the offsprings.
Yeah, it's true. But the image that comes across sometimes is one that really puts men in an identity crisis.
And I agree with you, and this is totally reinforced, and I'm saying that as a foreigner coming to this country during this this identity, male identity crisis started, I think. And I saw it. My first degree was in advertising, so every time I see an ad, I'm like looking, you know, I look at it as a professional more than I just, you know, it doesn't process the same way, I guess, because I know every stage behind it, what it's supposed to do to you. And I've realized that every time in a TV ad commercial, they need the idiot, you know, the one that doesn't understand or something.
Buffoon.
It's always the buffoon. It's always, every single time, a young, white, American male. You know, the one that doesn't know how to do things. The one that, you know, falls into a wall. Or what?
A father.
Yeah.
A lot of times.
Yeah, exactly. It's reinforced into your brains. You know, you're stupid. You don't know how to do this. You know, you don't know that. You don't know this. I mean, it's absolutely unbelievable.
And
you
the
know,
schooling
how,
system, too. Yeah, to break you down, to make you complacent.
And
how
can
you... has become more friendly to the female brain, you get... Well, that's why young boys are diagnosed.
I don't agree.
It's friendly.
It's not friendly.
It's no longer friendly to the males, let's say.
It's really unfriendly to everybody. You know?
Equally.
But there's
an entire generation of young men who are being diagnosed with ADD left and right.
Yeah, exactly.
Many of whom...
That's for money.
They don't have it.
That's a whole other bag of cash. I mean, but I've noticed that the women portrayed the spouses of these buffoon husbands are you know, complete witches. Mm-hmm. At the same time, they're control freaks. They're angry constantly because they have a buffoon for a husband, but they're also angry at all the things that are required of them. And oh my gosh, ha ha ha! Let's laugh over everyone's misery.
But it's done on purpose. This is a science, you know, as much as you know, seriously, and it's well studied. In fact, in many ways, what's going on now is what has been done to people of color in over the past century, since racism was invented,
the disempowerment
to justify
slave
trade
of the whole race.
But seriously, they use the same mechanization. Dr. Cornel West has a very strong writing about that, and he calls it the Americanization of America. Mm-hmm. That now we are all treated like people of color were treated and continue to be treated. But now it's everybody. So you really undermine people, you destroy their family relationships, you destroy their self-esteem, etc. And they become better drones to sell stuff.
Oh, in fact, I'm really glad you're saying this, because I wanted to say that, you know, like those young, okay, but it's always like a young white male are totally replacing the blacks in movies in the 70s, you know, how the, like, you have to focus on somebody else, but somebody else has to be bad, and you guys.
Read the Willie Lynch letter. That's some
it's terrible.
Thought, yeah.
So anyway, yes, Talia.
I've noticed in commercials that is completely true, but instead of seeing it like that, I think, why would they use commercials to sell their product by making someone stupid? I mean, I don't get it. Why would they take some buffoon, some guy, portray him as a father or, I don't know, and then try to, like, sell, I don't know, Lunchables? Like, that's super annoying commercial that we all hate and we remember.
No. It's very
anyway,
mercantilist. But you take...
You take a buffoon and have him sell something. How does that work? Why do you...
Actually, because you're selling to people...
Sold something by someone who's completely stupid.
You're selling something to
obviously
people they don't want. You're selling stuff they don't want, they don't need, or in the case of food, poison. or slave labor merchandise you don't really need, that hurting a lot of people that you don't really intend to hurt. So again, if we were selling, you know, goods competing, informing the public about what this good is, and look at my good, it's better than everybody else, it's a good price, check it out. But sadly, there's very little of that left in our commercial world. We're selling things that we don't need, produced in very costly and inefficient ways, so we need to dupe you. It's no longer an honest sale, it's a scam, in a sense. And
they're setting a low standard for their consumer as well, which makes people more comfortable, which is sad in of itself.
Look at me, I'm such a loser, but if I buy this product, then I'll be good.
Yeah.
You see, that's the mechanism, instead of saying, buy this because it's a good stuff, check it out. But that really hardly exists anymore. I'm a loser. I have an empty, and my, you know, my soul is empty. So maybe if I buy this deodorant, somebody will love me. It's very sad. You know?
Yeah,
it's
yeah.
Sad.
After
it's absolutely ridiculous too. I mean, I'm glad that we're discussing family roles, because today what we wanted to focus on our show had a lot to do with mothers and daughters.
Yeah.
And specifically, the reason we have Molly. We have Molly here is to discuss her performance play that she's doing, her show at the Fringe Festival starting this weekend, and has everything to do with mothers and daughters. Why don't you give us a little background on that?
Well, thank you. It was really fascinating listening to this discussion, because it was reminding me of a song that occurs early in this musical review. It's all music. It's a 90-minute show that I wrote, and it's a song after song. And early in the show, there's a song called Job Application. I mean, it's something that a lot of us can relate to these days, right?
Yes.
Having
it's
to
like
my big fear. I get so much anxiety when
exactly.
I apply for jobs.
Well, and it's like trying to fit you, a whole rounded person, into these boxes and check and check that, and this is me, and it's like, wait a minute, how do you do that? And and a lot of times, as we were talking about education and how it doesn't quite add up to things that are really important on a job, you know, in the song, I'm looking for these specific job titles that I'm not finding. It's like, well, why don't they have morale booster? Creative force, a sympathetic ear, multitasker extraordinaire. Why aren't any of these jobs listed here? I say in the song, it's like these things are like so important to the success of a business, to the success in life, and yet you're never going to be hired to be one of those things. But it's a qualitative thing. It's not something that can be evaluated quantitatively. So therefore, it doesn't exist in the job world. It doesn't exist.
No, but it's something that definitely can be found in a. In a retelling of a fairy tale.
Absolutely, and in a relationship. And yeah. this show is all about relationships. I mean, the title of the show, I, You, We, kind of, it's a parallel for how we grow in life. We start out as a little egocentric baby. It's all about feed me, love me. And then we progress to, you know, through our adolescence, like, oh, there's you. Ooh, I love you, and what about you, and how do you relate to me? So it's I, then progresses to you. Then it, as we grow older, we really start to see the we. It's like, what are we here for? How do we? How can we make a better world? How can we work together? What's up with this whole world thing?
Interdependence.
You know? Exactly, yeah. And how do we all connect?
If we grow up, I mean, you know.
Well, okay, there you go.
But that's a female show, right?
It's a generation of females, right? Multi-generational, so it represents the Talias. It has adolescents. It has kids looking at things from their vantage point. It has grandma looking at things from a more wiser, we hope, but sassy at the same time point of view. There's nothing heading out to pasture about her. And then a couple of moms at different stages. An older mom who's looking at her kids leaving the nest, and you know what's up for them, and what's up for her. And a younger mom still in the throes of, oh my goodness, my life is all about diapers. And where's me in all of this? You know, so it's really looks at things from a lot of different angles of life. You know, all the things that we're doing in life, and there's of course a lot of humor. Isn't that how we cope?
Mm-hmm. Why don't we play a track?
Sure.
I'd love to sample a track and sure. So that our audience can know what you mean. Let's go ahead and start with the opening.
Okay.
I'm in the right space.
I hope,
I pray,
I know,
I don't
know. So in that's the way the show starts. It's like from the point of view of six characters, what do I do? And what am I looking for? So it's a little glimpse into each of these personas. We have the young teen who, at the end, who's like, I don't know if I'm in the right space. I mean, seriously, isn't that how we felt when we were young teens? What am I doing here? Everybody's looking at me.
I don't remember.
And I start the show, my character starts out the show rather pretty honestly. I hope I don't disappoint. I mean, seriously, you know, when you write a show and you put your heart out there for a million people to see, you want to make sure that people are understanding it and appreciating it and enjoying it. And, you know, that's a rather honest place to come from. Our piano player, who actually is one of the busiest piano players in this entire city, Kathy Slage, she's awesome. See, isn't she awesome? And her line and opening line in that, I work for the whole human race. And isn't that the truth?
She really does. She plays for so many people.
Exactly.
That's funny.
Yeah, so each of their characters kind of has a little glimpse of who they are. And then, of course, each one of those threads gets explored in the show.
Yeah, and worth mentioning, too, when your husband was on the show, he said that the opening number of a theater production starts with what the character is internally, their, you know, the characterization, but also what they're seeking or what they want. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it's interesting that your character says, well, what I don't want is to disappoint somebody.
Yeah. And that isn't that often the female condition? We're always kind of like apologizing for this or that, or, you know, oh, I don't want to interrupt, or oh,
pretty polite and passive.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm.
So. But, you know, it comes, I mean, as the card-carrying feminist economist in the room. I am a member of the association. It's very important. In fact, in all honesty, maybe, you know, it's not the place here, but feminism, literally in the somewhat radical sense of defeating the patriarchy, the society that is ostensibly, you know, ruled by men, and women are second rate citizens to a significant extent, and I'll say in a second why they are still even here, is a core prerequisite for solving our problems in the world, whether it be poverty, environment. I mean, I can get technical, but I won't. Don't worry. I should devote my show to that, at least one, by the way. So it's a core issue because it is extremely debilitating. It's damaging. Now, why, essentially? Because women, I mean, we see this notion of having to please in many cases being, you know, gender role by the princess's culture and all that. But it comes from a good place originally, right? Because we call it, you know, the care industry, right? Who takes care of kids? Unpaid. Who takes care of old parents? Unpaid. Who takes care of, you know, generally whoever needs care in this world of ours? Generally, mostly unpaid. It's at least a third, by most measured, conservative measures, of the economic activity that takes place in the modern world. Goes unpaid. So, beside the point that women are barely getting 70 cents per hour, per dollar, that males are making for equivalent skills, equivalent jobs, they also have... Like, they're also producing a third of our gross domestic product, you know?
And holding schools together.
At the same time, without getting paid.
Parent volunteers hold the schools together.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, all that care stuff.
More and more. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All that care stuff. So you see, this is again, it's not about, oh, doing the right thing. It's core, just pay people what they earn, or at least give them the institutions necessary. Our lack of healthcare. In this country, and increasingly in more and more countries, even rich countries that are following us on this, in Europe, for example, is...
Don't say France.
Well, yeah, France is falling apart.
Don't
it
say
is falling
France.
Apart. You know, you'd be surprised how bad things are going. I just hope that they take care of business in the way that French know how to take care of business. Like,
don't speak about France.
But anyway. But all of Europe, sorry. Union. following America down the drain in many ways, or even overtaking it in some ways. There's more austerity there than here, right? So the policies are terrible. But, to go back, no child care, senior moment, child leave after birth, you know?
Paid maternity leave.
Mm-hmm. Right? Very shoddy healthcare system, a very shoddy school system. That is paid much more by women than men. So once again, all the costs, and I'm talking for a kind of a very hard-nosed kind of market system capitalist perspective here. It's just these markets are highly unbalanced, and we shouldn't be surprised that our families are falling apart, that our schools are falling apart, that, well, everything's kind of falling apart.
I wish there was a way to live without having to work for a wage, because...
Yeah, you can become a farmer and have your chicken and your eggs every morning, a cow that you can milk.
Well, who do you buy your clean water from? Who do you get your electricity from?
Well, you get
from?
A well. You get a well.
Good
you
luck
don't
with that.
You
know,
live by candlelight.
The friendly neighborhood power
grid.
Company
you
is
have bees and you produce your own.
It just seems like, I mean, why even work for a dollar when the second you make a dollar, you're depreciating the value of a dollar because of the way that debt works as we print money we don't have. It's just
you can't abandon everybody. There's no place to escape.
No.
Have to get together, solidarity among people of different shapes, colors, persuasions, and everything, and save our world.
But it's sick. The more money we make, the more debt we accrue.
You can get together.
That's why we have to remember that, I mean, life and the beauty of life comes from things that aren't money. And we got to remember that, because if we spend so much time focusing on how much our economy, is just dying, then I mean, gosh, it gets depressing. We have to remember that there's so much more to life, and that family and friends and loved ones and relationships and art and everything out there that we enjoy and love and
our society
and our faiths and our societies. That's what makes life worth living. Not the money. Not the economy. Not the austerity that we receive, and those things are great, and we need those things.
No, but that is the.
But that's the thing, though.
Having food to feed your children.
Yeah.
Having a decent job.
I mean,
not working your mom to an early grave. I mean, society. You know, economy broadly defined. Right, though. The focus on money is catastrophic, because we should focus on our general good life. To go back to the old.
But as someone, I don't know. I find like a certain responsibility to be angry. I can't just look at art and just forget about money, because I think artists should use what's going on as a platform for maybe some of their artwork.
Not to mention artists don't make any money.
Yeah. No one's buying art right now. No one can afford it.
in my show, the grandma character has a sort of funny commentary on this situation as increasingly affecting our elderly. The song is called Retirement, and she talks, her opening line is, "I'll enjoy my golden years in a chain store. Be the greeter, hand out stickers and a smile." Yeah. So it's...
do you want to listen?
Seriously.
Yeah.
And,
right?
You know, it's a little bit of sarcasm there, but
it kind of hits
the button there.
Yes. Yeah. I'll be a bagger. You know, as soon as the university throws me out, I'll end up being a bagger at Publix. I mean, there is no way we can retire with the money we're making it as a professor.
No, by then we'll fix things up. We'll be
three diplomas.
You really think so?
I have to keep a hope. The fight alive. It's not hope. It's not like, oh, things will get better. It's like, you know,
I'm
gonna fight. And if I go down fighting, then I'll go down fighting. But I will not go down, pretending that things are great. That's just wrong historically.
I agree 100%. It's denial to pretend like, you know, we can just
talk about what Molly was saying, old people. That's another. I said how women are, but yeah, what about old people? You know, mm-hmm. I mean, what sick society
ageism
do we live in, right? In which old people are, you know, discarded and gross, right? I mean, no other society. I mean, there's some messed up societies out there, but they still respect their elders. You know, they're not as sick.
No, well, and respecting nature, as we were talking about, the things that are precious in life are free. In fact, that's the title of... What a segue there. The precious things in life are free. That's one of the ending songs in my show. It's kind of a central thing to the theme as I explored it a few times in totally perverse ways in the show. I'm a huge fan of Robert Frost poems, and I totally butcher one of his most famous ones in two of my songs. The first one is called 10 Roads Diverged in a Crowded Wood, and it's all about me, the totally too busy multitasker mom who's faced with the beckoning of the lovely old woods, trying to draw her in to commune with nature, and she's just missing the point entirely. Her take on it is that she has to conquer all the 10 roads, so she completely misses the point right over her head. And then my daughter in the show has her take on it, and her song is called 2 Roads Diverged in a Mellow Woods. Well, she finds herself in the midst of nature, and what is she looking for? Cell phone reception. So she doesn't find it. She ends up going to the coffee store. You know, it's like a cafe Wi-Fi. Like, I'm out of here. So
modern,
it's like nature is calling to us, but are we paying attention?
So anybody met the wolf?
The wolf is everywhere.
Because, you know, we don't have to worry about our grandmothers and our elderly. They're all going to be eaten by the wolf soon. You know?
That's right. The wolf is everywhere. And sometimes we're our own worst wolf.
To join in.
Exactly. Let's embrace the wolves. Wolves that are up there.
The wolf is the
us.
Cell phone.
The wolf is a cell phone. The wolf is our own obsession with things that really don't matter, you know?
I mean, you could read it that way. That's
yeah. Sometimes
I
it can be
differently,
that.
But
yeah,
it can be different things.
Shall we play another?
I think we should.
Which one?
Okay, so 10 roads, 2 roads.
2 roads. Oh, let's do 2 roads because it's a lot of fun.
Right.
Okay.
And it's these ancient woods for my daughter, of course, are her ancient music, which is 50s, 60s. So there you go. That's
which
ancient.
One is that? Penelope?
That's perfect. Amelia.
That's Amelia.
Amelia okay. Dutton.
Your daughter.
On the solo.
She got two of them.
And two of them singing.
Yes, yeah, so I will have to play the Penelope's
show.
Too.
Okay, here we are.
One, two, three, four. 2 roads diverged in a mellow wood.
Mellow, mellow, when the wood is so good.
And sorry, dear wood, I had no horse.
No horse, no horse, no horse, of course.
Just I, one traveler, there I stood and dialed my cell phone as I could.
She could.
In hopes my GPS would plot my course.
Her course, no horse, of course.
Reception there was middling fair.
Reception fair, no fair, no fair.
But having perhaps the better plan.
She's got a plan, a better self plan.
I text or Twitter, wondering where if internet could pass through there.
There
we're dialing on some ancient line of land.
Ancient land, line of land.
And both that morning I did find.
Two roads, gotta choose for you, lose your mind.
In tracing turning steps going down.
Push him back, way back.
Oh, the woods must wait. I must.
friends of Joe O'Mine.
Plugged in afresh, my world's content.
She's all plugged in on a network content.
Two roads diverged in a wooden eye.
I
beat it to cafe Wi-Fi.
She beat it out the woods, went to cafe Wi-Fi.
And that has made
Bravo. I like it.
My gosh. And Molly, you wrote this entire thing.
Yeah.
Did you compose all of the music?
All the music. Every single note.
Good grief. Yes.
That's a lot of music.
Well, it was a labor of love for my mom, getting back to mothers. This was something that I've been wanting to do for a long time, put all of my little songs I had here and there into a show. And my mom was diagnosed with lymphoma. And there was something in my brain that just said, you know, life is short. You got to do it. And it wasn't even a direct connection. It was just suddenly all these songs started pouring out of me and became this show. So I'm really happy to share it with my dearest friends and family. Amy Gifford's in the show. Christina Carter's in the show.
Beautiful.
Kathy Slade, yeah. My other daughter, Penelope. And it was for my mom.
That's wonderful. Yeah. It's like the tradition of storytelling is so important. I mean, we stress that all the time when we talk about fairy tales and about how... And like what you were saying earlier with the job applications, how there isn't a job for moral support and ideas. And
there should be.
But
it's
you
so
know,
important.
The relationship from a mother can be that. And it is a free one.
Absolutely.
It is precious to.
One of the centerpieces of this show is a song called Motherhood Anthem. And it really kind of asks us to stretch our interpretation of what is a mother? Because really, is a mother just this stereotype that we think of? Or is a mother any person who's motherly? So the song really opens up our minds and our hearts to seeing a mother is somebody who loves a pet and nurtures and takes care of anybody, friends, family. It could be a male, it could be a female. It's someone who is motherly.
And it's ironic, too, I mean, on the discussion of fairy tales, that these fairy tales were mostly passed between the mouths of women from mother to daughter, yet most of these fairy tales are motherless. I mean...
Yeah.
Yes, totally. And the funny thing is that, you know, they make us believe that, oh yeah, fairy tales are told by mothers to their daughters. So a lot of them, I mean, the women's
orally,
fairy tales,
yeah.
the women's fairy tale tradition of the 17th century was definitely like that. If you look at Madame de Murat, Madame d'Aulnoy, Mademoiselle de la Force, and so on. This is really the tradition. You know, the mother is actually teaching something to her daughter. But if we look at the fairy tale tradition that has stuck with us, which is the Perrault model, you know, the one Cinderella, Little Red Riding Hood, Sleeping Beauty, and so on. No mothers. There are no mothers. If there are mothers, there are mean stepmothers. The grandmothers get eaten. You know, the girls are, you know, the ones that are under the foot of patriarchal supremacy. I mean, there is not really a mother. So the funniest thing is like, oh, and who tells fairy tales to their children? We do, right? Women. Mm-hmm. We are the ones that tell fairy tales to our children. Our husbands usually don't read the Grimm's fairy tales, you know?
Disney now.
I was just
right. Exactly. Yes.
But we, in reality, exactly. We read stories that were written by males for reinforcing the patriarchy, right? Mm. Perrault, and then the Grimms, and then now Disney.
Often co-opted, taking, I mean, remind the reader that the Charlotte Scholarship is a lot about that, about exposing the fact that the stories we know, written by men, are masculinized kind of versions of the original stories often told by women.
Yeah, exactly. The women tradition, which the women fought so much at the end of the 17th century to keep alive their tradition while they saw it had been hijacked by the men. This tradition, nobody talks about it. Like, we don't know that there is a Cinderella that actually at the end refuses to marry the prince until she has negotiated her marriage contract. That is completely gone from tradition. oh, but the little girl, you know, that has to be, you know, the little helper and rises up to the prince and marries him and lives happily ever after, you know, the one that never, ever, ever gets underneath the boots of patriarchy, because her stepmother, in order to stay afloat with the patriarchy, she has to basically annul that little girl, take everything from her, and try to give it to her own daughters, you know,
right.
Hence the evil stepmother. She does that in order to preserve herself and her progeny. Posterity, exactly, into that patriarchal male. So basically all the fairy tales we are reading to our children reinforce that, while we are the women telling our girls, and our boys also, but especially our girls, those patriarchal stories, while in fact they were written by me, well, not all of them, but a lot of them were written by women or told by women. Traditionally we say, oh yeah, women tales, blah blah, you know, fairy tales were told by wet nurses, that's Perrault's line. Oh yeah, those are stupid stories because they were told by wet nurses to children to put them to sleep. Which is true for nursery rhymes, basically, but not so much for fairy tales.
Well, to our listeners, now that the ignorance is gone, you have a social responsibility now to make sure
that you know the real fairy tales.
That you know the real fairy tales, yeah. Absolutely.
Because she's saying, like, what an irony to tell our girls today, just like the whole princess culture, right? I mean, you know, well, you got to stab your sisters in the back in order to make it in life, right? Or else,
yeah.
Right? And in order to be in the good graces of the prince.
Exactly.
And,
yeah. And what's very unsettling with this whole, you know, modern fairy tale tradition, like this male fairy tale tradition, is that they have completely inoculated, right?
Mm-hmm.
The motherhood. There is no mom. There are never, like, when is the only two moms that I can remember in Disney.
Sleeping Beauty, no lines.
No lines, absolutely
right.
Zero. She doesn't say a word. And Mulan, and same thing. She has very little to say. And who has a lot of verbiage to say is that terrible, ugly matchmaker.
Mm.
Which is, in fact, the stepmother. She, you know, she takes away the daughter into the adulthood. And, you know, in order to transform her, Mulan, into something that can be acceptable by the patriarchy, exactly what the stepmothers do in traditional fairy tales.
Mm-hmm.
She fights it,
she
absolutely.
Does.
She does fight it. But at the end, you know, she goes back. If you look at this is based on a true story, Mulan, but it's also based, if you look at the structure of the fairy tale, is much more based on the 17th century fairy tales about women warriors than it is based on the true story of Mulan. You know, the way they have made a fairy tale out of it. And Disney. And it's really, at the end, she goes back into the patriarchy. You know, all she wants really is to marry the general.
In the second movie.
Mm.
In the first two.
In the first two?
I mean, she fights for her dad.
The second one should not exist. The sequel should not exist.
Yeah, exactly. Anyway.
The second, you know, Cinderella's not that good either.
The first one, I mean, it's all about, you know, her fighting to save the patriarchal role of her father, which is fun. It's also in the 17th century fairy tales. But then it's all about her getting the prince, which is the general, you know, whatever.
Well, let me ask, what necessarily is wrong with that? What is wrong with her marrying the prince? What is wrong with her fighting alongside the men and then earning the respect of the prince and then marrying the prince?
There is nothing especially wrong with that. But there is nothing wrong with that. But you can always say that, as a lot of critics have said about the heroines of Madame d'Aulnoy, that she escapes the patriarchal rules. While she is a warrior and she fights along the men, and remember at the beginning she gains the respect of the men, but it's very hard for her her to do so, right? She's belittled a long time, I mean at least half an hour into a 1.5 hour movie.
Mulan's kind of a Disney exception.
And then yeah. and then she accepts that, but then she returns back into the patriarchy. Once she steps out to help patriarchy, and then at the end she comes back into
and it. She has to give up her power. She can that's fall in thing. Love, get married.
If it becomes
that's
her identity,
she doesn't need
right.
to be submissive.
Well, you need you see you remember at the end she comes back home, she takes off all her warrior things, and she becomes a girl again. And that's when he comes back and he sees her and he falls in love with her and they get married. So she has to strip down and goes back to her woman role.
Her female identity. Or her
female identity,
right.
Exactly.
But, I mean, and like that's not the only issue. It's the issue of beauty and the gender identity. It's also an issue of unrealistic expectations on love. Like, take Cinderella, for example, Del Noir's version, Disney version. In the Disney version, Cinderella and the prince interact for what, maybe a couple hours until the stroke of midnight, and suddenly he's in love. I mean, that talk about an unrealistic expectation.
Oh, well. Remember Dolnois? The prince falls in love with the shoe.
With the shoe.
He's
sick
never
over
seen
a girl.
Yeah, it's a shoe fetish.
Someone has an issue.
Yeah, but yeah, the, but Cinderella
so
didn't
sick.
Fall for it.
No, she didn't even
Disney,
know him.
Disney, she did. Yeah.
But at the end, you know, the critics say, well, she goes back to patriarchy because, okay, she negotiates her marriage contract, fine, mm-hmm. but then she goes back and marries the prince, you know, so although she's never seen the prince before.
Well, obviously the solution isn't
she's
to just never get married and never fall in love.
So.
What are these women supposed to do? You know, from your perspective, what are these women supposed to do to not return to that place?
Oh, not my perspective. I don't count. The 17th century women's perspective, well, in a lot of the 17th century fairy tales, just because you probably don't know that, but they come from the end, you know, 1690 mm-hmm. and on. But in the 1650s, there were super strong women in France that fought, you know, took arms and fought against the power, the government and stuff like that. And those women were called Amazons. And one of the most prolific writer of that period is Mademoiselle de Scudéry. And in one of her books, she basically says that she's a discussing, you know, there is two characters discussing in the book. And one says, well, you know, the only way to escape everything is not to get married. Which a lot of novels end up having their characters doing that, you know, married the first time when they are 15, but then when they can marry again, even if they are in love or not, they just don't because they choose their freedom. Example of the Princess of Cleves, for example. But so in the Scudéry's novel, one character says, well, let's not get married at all. And the other one says, well, if you don't get married, you have nothing. So basically what you need to do is get married as long as you negotiate your marriage contract. So basically, you're in power. This
marriage
time.
Of equals. I mean, it goes back to your point yeah. from the beginning, because do not forget, that's you know, power flows both ways. So this hurts boys, too. It's actually yeah. what's hurting boys. The fact, you know, boys are afraid of strong women. Why? You know, on the contrary. You know, boys should love strong women. You know, why not? You know, a marriage, a love of equality that doesn't require one submissive and one not. It messes up with minds of girls and boys.
Yeah.
It's a kind of a divide and conquer element, you know, the war of the sexes. There doesn't have to be a war of the sexes.
And I would argue that there is nothing wrong with a strong woman. And as men, we should not be afraid of strong women. But at the same time, what is scary for me as a young man is not necessarily a strong woman, but a commandeering woman who there's a difference. Because to me, I find a woman who is strong and able to stand on her own absolutely beautiful. But at the same time, a woman who is going to control everything is going to turn into the evil stepmother.
Yeah, no, absolutely
exactly.
right.
Exactly.
That is so true.
It's out of balance.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. So I guess the question that we have is, because we talked earlier about it, like you were saying about the identity crisis that young men are facing in this generation. I think that young women are also facing identity crisis mm-hmm. because the question is, a lot of, and forgive me if this offends anybody, but a lot of what feminism has done is tried to make women more like men. Which
yes.
in some yes. cases,
false
in some
feminism.
Cases,
false feminism.
Indeed,
yes.
no, but a lot yeah. of those calling themselves feminists are terrible.
I would agree with that, because when I hear the term feminism as a man,
right. we need to define
I get very
that
defensive because
within.
I'm like that could
right.
mean either women
yeah.
needing equality, which I agree with, or it can mean this attitude of women needing to be like men,
not even equal, by the way. I
and
guess.
That's and I think
women
that's,
aren't equal to men, thankfully.
And that is what that is what a lot of men are scared of, is mm-hmm. we're not scared of being equal with mm-hmm. women, we're scared of women being men.
Or being emasculated by a woman.
Exactly.
And that's a good point. That's the reason that I, when we started with that fairy tale, that I brought up that point. I think that's what I was getting at. And in the context of our conversation, I wish we didn't say this retroactively, but yes, our definition of feminism is true feminism, not false feminism of a woman pretending to be a man.
Yeah.
Enabling, you know, women to be women in good conditions.
So I guess the question we need to ask ourselves.
To men.
Yeah. The question that we need to ask ourselves going forward, you know, through time and through society is, what is a woman and what is a man? Because they're not the same thing.
Yes.
They are equal, but they're different. They're not the same thing.
Exactly. That's a crucial.
But also remember that within every person, there are elements of masculinity and femininity, mm-hmm. and beyond your gender, you are still an individual. And because of that, there will be commonalities between men and women.
There will always be
commonalities. Just as human. But what is a man? What is a woman? What is a strong man? What is a weak woman? I mean, let's really think about
it. Let's put that on the agenda seriously. My show definitely too. You know, I mean, you know, we had our 2 hours on race, and we need to do some feminism because you're so right. I mean, my feminist friend, if you will, they write books and papers about what you just said.
Yes, and I agreed. Since
I've written a college paper on the same thing too.
Yeah, I'm glad to hear that. That's enlightening to me because for years I've only been exposed to feminism, which is very, quite frankly, terrifying.
I know.
Sure.
So we need to disambiguate that and explain what we mean about feminism, because in some, that kind of feminism is working for the patriarchy, I would tell you. You know?
Yes.
It's replacing women. It's forcing women to rise by not being women, and that just puts women down in the long run.
What I think is that, you know, even though economically we have moved along from mercantilism, I think emotionally and certainly in fairy tales and the way we represent this war as this quarrel between men and women, as you know, it was actually in 16th century, you called it the quarrel of the women. It's a long, like, since the Middle Ages, you know, French women have been like, okay, hold on, you know, me, Eve, no way. Let's restart all over here. So anyway, the quarrel of the women. What I think is, and especially in fairy tales, we have not gotten out of the mercantile model. And in mercantilism, correct me if I'm wrong, you know, when you have a certain amount of power, a certain amount of money, if you take power away from... Exactly, the zero-sum theory.
Zero-sum game, right.
The game. Well, if you take money away, or money or power away from the men... No, if you give power to the women, it's obviously that you take power away from the men. Mm-hmm. There is no more of what is there. You know, you can't expand power.
So there's a finite amount of power.
It's always to the detriment of the other, which is...
False.
BS completely.
Yeah, that's a mind-forged manacle.
The market system, with its weaknesses and successes over the past 250 years that came after mercantilism, if you will, challenged that precisely. Said, no, we could actually all rise together, getting more efficient, etc.
Yeah, which is kind of a lot of what the American economic system is trying to be based
used
on.
Emotionally, we have not. Emotionally, we have not evolved from that. You know, if I give you power to you, my wife, then it means that I'm going to have less power. You know, we have not...
It's part of the misinformation.
Mad Men, good show for that, you know, because it's exactly that. It's like every time they try, you know, every time a man gives power to his girl, his woman, basically he's threatened by the fact that he's getting power away from himself. And this is a show, obviously, about the 50s, but it's produced now. You know
because
what I mean?
Make no mistake.
Because
it's contemporary.
I mean, we're back to mercantilism. We no longer think that way.
Yes, but emotionally we've never been away from it.
You're right. You're so right. I never even made that connection before. That there's a difference between the economics of the situation, which we're reverting back to, but also that hasn't changed emotionally at all. Mm-hmm. We've only, like what you were saying, just reacted differently to the same exact problem.
Mm-hmm.
That's what feminism is. It's a reaction.
Shows,
it's not
right?
pro-action.
Well, I think one interesting thing to look at, you're talking about the whole, you know, giving and taking of power and the concept of, you know, is power finite. From my perspective, and I'll just share, you know, some personal experience real quick. You know, I grew up in, you know, a very conservative church culture, and you know, and still very much today. You know, I come from a conservative Christian culture, and one thing that I've run into over the years are sometimes I run into girls in who I meet in church and meet in these, you know, this more traditional, a lot of them are homeschooled culture, and the thing that I run into is I actually run into the problem of trying to empower them, trying to in relationships saying, hey, where do you want to go eat? And they don't even, and a lot of times the reaction I get back is they want me to make all the decisions.
Where do you want to eat?
And that's bad for both sides. The other thing that I've run into.
Amen, brother.
The other thing that I've run, or one of the funniest things, just to throw this out there, one of the funniest things I ever heard in church, and this wasn't a church I was at, this was a recording I heard from one of my friends listening to a sermon. A pastor was giving a sermon on marriage and was talking about, you know, one of the most controversial books and or verses in the Bible, which is where it says, you know, men
to obey
or men love your wives as Christ loved the church, and women submit to your husbands. Mm-hmm. And he said something hilarious as he read this verse. Yeah, you know, he said something to the women, and I forget what it was, but he said something to men. And he said, "Men, let me make this very clear: if you heard that verse and something inside you went, yeah, you're an ass." And that's the reality. Is you know, from a Christian perspective, do we consider that verse truth because it's in the Bible? Yes, but the way that that's interpreted has been so misinterpreted over the years. Submission doesn't have to mean subservience, and that's what it's come to mean over the years. And subservience is not.
Submission is pretty strong.
I don't feel good about submission.
Interpretation is wide open. These are ancient texts, you know. We don't even know how they use language so much. You know,
that's true. It could mean completely different words.
The crazy thing is,
it's a duty to interpret them and realize they are interpreted.
The crazy thing is, on the other side of that verse, though, the concept of men love your wives like Christ loved the church is the concept of men, the responsibility we have, that means that we're commanded, scripturally from a Christian perspective, men are commanded to be willing to die for their wives. Mm-hmm. That's huge. Mm-hmm. And we can't forget that.
Women are committed to die for their...
No, men.
Men are committed men, to die
when,
for their
when
wives.
When you get married, mm-hmm. in a Christian tradition and faith, when you get married, you're commanded to love your wife like Christ loved the church. Mm-hmm. And Christ died for the church. So what that's essentially saying is you are commanded to love your wife in such a way that you would die for her.
To protect her.
To protect her.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And that's a huge responsibility.
But again, sadly, there are other people who call themselves Christians who interpret the stuff in very different ways.
Yeah.
But that's the nature of the beast, of course.
I remember we went to a wedding, which was a Catholic, Hispanic wedding. And... The priest actually said to the girl that she needed to love her man and even die for him.
Well, both, didn't they? I don't know.
I thought it was just a girl, and we were like, what?
It was
rambling. Since when, you know? Well, anyway, yeah, it was funny. But
time.
Yeah, we have to die for each other, that's for sure.
I mean, the traditional, and this isn't always true, but the model that I was taught growing up was that women, in a marriage relationship, a woman needs to support her husband and support what he does and be there for him and be his helper.
Shouldn't they both support?
And a man, it's support goes both ways. And a man's responsibility is to protect and to be willing to die for and to provide for. And it goes both ways. Both need to support each other and both provide for each other. But it's the concept of women as nurturers, nurturing, and men as warriors protecting.
Oh, she's here.
Well, the truth is that a man can't breastfeed anyway. So I mean, if we're talking about the biology, Benny.
Remind Molly's show, and we just have to continue this. An hour is never enough. And
no, I know. What a bummer. But what I will say is that one strong point of femininity is, of course, motherhood. And with that, we're going to close with Molly's song, Mother's Anthem.
Motherhood Anthem.
The show starts tomorrow.
Yep.
Right?
At the
tomorrow.
Festival.
Please
you can find out more information.
The website.
OrlandoFringe.org or at my website iuwe.me.
Okay, wait a second. And we need to tell our audience that
we thank you for this happy accident of a guest. The person who hosted the show before ours is who I haven't introduced yet. Why don't you go ahead and introduce yourself?
Hey, it's Steven. I do shows here and work here.
Cool. It's just before us, and he decided to stay.
He hung
out. The conversation was too interesting to walk out.
That's right. Thank you
so much
for it. You're welcome anytime. And I want to shout out two more things.
I've got two shout outs.
Happy birthday to my sister.
Well, happy birthday.
Since we are talking about women and family
relationships, absolutely.
My sister's birthday is today, and also my very good friend Ben Buckingham's birthdays today too.
Wait
so
a second.
He's about two generations younger than my sister, I guess, because he's one of those kids. But happy birthday, both of you.
And also, I've gotten two more shout outs. One to Guinevere Cooper. For
yes,
your wedding
thank you
for story.
And
it was
thank
great.
You for starting our discussion, Jennifer.
Yes. And another shout out to all locked doors out there. Thank you for locking me out of the WPRK radio station. Thank you so much.
I didn't realize that happened. All right. Well, thanks again to Molly. Go ahead and check out We at the Fringe Festival going on for the next several days. Thanks to Charlotte Tronquet Dulis, our scholar and child expert Talia Balak there.
Thanks so much for having
father
me.
And husband Benny Balak and myself Kristen Eves. We'll see you next Wednesday from 9 to 10 on WPRK 91.5 FM.
Bye. Bye.